Jesus says, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." This is what it means to live this way. It is a way of living that makes room for everyone and gives special consideration to those who have been overlooked, oppressed, forgotten, thrown away, or simply ignored.
That's the Reverend Carla Jones Brown. And today she brings you a powerful message entitled From Childish to Childlike. I'm Katie Givens-Kime, and this is Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Kime. And today on Day One, we're honored to have back for the second week in a row, the Reverend Carla Jones Brown. Reverend Jones Brown is the senior pastor of the Arch Street Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She is the first woman and first person of color to serve in this role in the church's 169-year history. She grew up in the Baptist Church and was ordained at Second Baptist Church of Long Branch, New Jersey in 2005. In addition to her work in the church, Reverend Jones Brown serves as the dean of the Jerina Lee Preaching Academy and as cohort leader for Woman Preach Incorporated. Reverend Jones Brown is a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, where she earned a Master of Divinity degree in 2004, and she received the Edward Howell Roberts Scholarship in Preaching. Carla, welcome back to Day One. We are so glad to have you with us again.
I am honored to be invited back.
Just getting to know you and the whole rich, wide terrain of your ministry and where you've been and where you are and where you're going. You're someone who grew up in the Baptist tradition, and now you're serving in the Presbyterian Church in the PCUSA. That's I'm sure, surely was a journey. How would you say your diverse denominational background has influenced your approach to ministry and leadership and all of it?
I love the question, mostly because I wish it is a question that I had heard someone else answer before I entered this terrain. For the funniest part of this for me is when I was at a Baptist church and felt the call, went to a Presbyterian seminary because it was in state, not because I knew all of the wonderful things that were going to happen there. When I graduated, I was ordained by a commission of Baptist ministers who wanted to make sure that the Presbyterians had not ruined me for Baptist polity. Fast forward 15 years, the Presbyterians now want to make sure that my ordination is secure and that being Baptist has not ruined that good Presbyterian education. And it all comes down to baptism and the Lord's Supper. Mm. And I am just tickled that our spiritual ancestors have done all of the hard academic work. And I get to say, oh, baptizing babies? Yeah, that's not a deal breaker. I guess I can do this Presbyterian thing. There are people who hold it a lot tighter. My experience with God is the tighter you hold it, the wronger you probably are. Mm. As wrong as the word wronger. But it has given me an opportunity to frame diverse experiences in a way that can only be lived. So I would say diversity can't simply be academic. It can't be something we just read about and we understand. You understand it because you are actually doing it. So there are things that I understand that may have been assumptions that as a good Baptist, you know, we're looking at others like, what do you mean you don't go under the water? And now I think God is far more gracious and generous than we humans can be at times. Mm. Bless our hearts.
Bless our hearts, yes. And so are there spaces where bringing in, so specifically the Lord's Supper and baptism, are there spaces where bringing in your really divergent theological experience and practical experience with them is a plus instead of a minus?
I think it's always a plus because it has made me a better listener. Mm. So I don't feel like I have to convince anyone. You know, when I say I grew up Baptist, bring whatever assumptions you bring to that, but also bring your questions. And maybe as we have a conversation, we will, in this conversation, discover that, oh, we really do have more in common than, oh, I didn't, huh, that's interesting. Can you imagine a world where people actually talked about their differences and realized that they're not as different as they think? Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's another, Jesus talked about that. That's another environment altogether.
right. Jesus had a couple things to say about that. Yeah. Well, to the point of divergent experiences and people bringing all sorts of perspectives theologically and otherwise to ministry, you and I know each other through the Ministry Collaborative. Mm-hmm. And say a bit about your experience there and how has that been part of your journey of just this rich diversity of denominations and theologies and ministry?
Yeah, Ministry Collaborative has been an incredible gift. And in my, the Ministry Collaborative existed long before I entered that world, but my entry into the Ministry Collaborative came right before the pandemic. And so a Philadelphia group of pastors who knew each other, we had lunch together, we did all sorts of things, became a cohort. That was the lead-in. After that cohort, I was then invited to a cohort of pastors of color who were pastoring in churches that did not necessarily reflect their backgrounds. And it wasn't until I was in that cohort that I realized how important it was to be seen for who I am and how important it is to know who I am as I am in spaces where other people might not share my background, where people might have questions that they're afraid to ask, where people are abiding by polite rules of society instead of good rules of engagement to getting to know one another, which I think is very important in the church, in the world of the work that we do as the church. The other thing that I think was incredibly helpful for me was it reminded me of the poem, We Wear the Mask. And it that particular cohort gave me a space to realize, oh, there's no mask here. You get to show up just as you are. But the reminder, so what mask are you wearing in this cross-cultural ministry? And is that fair to the people? And how do you then drop the mask so that you can actually be a real and genuine community? So it goes both ways, right? It was a here, learn about yourself, and also here, become better for your congregation.
Which is such a crucial thing. And we should say the Ministry Collaborative is a program and a network. It supports pastors and congregations and leadership in their community. And it's a program you and I have both been involved with.
And been blessed by.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Carla, in the world and in your life and in your ministry context lately, where have you seen God just blooming forth and showing up and glimmering forward?
In our downtown setting, in this day and age where no one is joining the church, we still have new member classes forming. I mean, people are still excited about what is happening in this beautiful building, even though we may make a different decision about what worship looks like. People are still in, oh, okay, cool. I can be a part of that change. Great. It's going to be hard work. Oh, okay, but I could be on a committee before I have to be in leadership. All right, cool. That is the most exciting thing that is happening in this season. And so that feels like God reminding us, yeah, I'm not done. I'm still collecting people. I'm still building this church. The second thing that I would just share, and here's a handy tip for pastors who pastor in downtown settings. Know how to say good morning and welcome in several languages. In our worship service yesterday, there were six people who were from France who had come to Philadelphia. And so all I had was, oh, bienvenue. And they were, but that was a connection point. And they stayed a little longer to have more conversation instead of just thank you for service and leaving. I can't make this up. After they left, two people came in who were from Italy.
What?
Right. So I asked them their names so that I could use my one word in Italian. Piacere. And their faces lit up and they felt seen. And for me, that's what it means to be available for diversity in in our setting. Who would have known that two words in different languages would help people feel like, oh, wow. Oh, that's cool. They were ready for me. Yes, we were.
Yep. And it was fine that they didn't, they were still comprehending your sermon. It's not about like, oh, well, you need to learn a whole language. It's just, it's the gesture and it's the
right.
welcome.
Right.
That's a beautiful thing and a great segue into what is such a powerful sermon from you, which we're excited to hear.
Thank you.
Now listen for God's word as we hear from the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 9, verses 30 through 37.
They went on from there and passed through Galilee. He did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him. And 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But they did not understand what he was saying, and were afraid to ask him. Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Now, Reverend Carla Jones Brown's sermon entitled From Childish to Childlike.
Let us pray. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O God, our rock, our strength, and our redeemer. Amen. On this day, in light of this text, where Jesus shares his passion prediction for the second time and is still misunderstood by his beloved disciples, I am reminded of an episode of Grey's Anatomy from 2014, which left a lasting impression on me. In that episode, a man is involved in a car accident and must decide whether he wants to remain on life-saving machinery or remove all supports and face the inevitable. His doctor, Christine Yang, is required to ask him a series of questions as he considers this decision. I find these questions especially powerful. She asks, "Do you know who you are? Do you know what's happened to you? Do you want to live this way?" These questions are helpful as we consider today's passage from Mark's gospel and the weight of this life of discipleship. Here, we meet the disciples and Jesus after he has been transfigured on the mountain and then returned to heal a boy possessed by a demon. Surely the disciples are catching on that this is no ordinary teacher. Surely they are witnessing these events and making the connections, like we would. I mean, wouldn't we? Would we not be smart enough with all of our technological advances to do a background check on Jesus before following him to ensure that he's credible? Would we not be wise enough to figure out his game plan and mind map it onto an app on our devices to share with others who are not as advanced and as wise as we are? Bless our hearts as we strive to be at the top of our Jesus following game. If disciples received badges like scouts, then we would be on our way to our discipleship, followership, and servant leadership badges. It's too bad that we would be working in the wrong direction if we solely worked to earn those badges. We are not scouts working to earn a badge that signals how great we are. We are not top performing students seeking the best grade in the class. We are followers of the one who led by example and stayed focused on the parameters of his purpose. Unlike the character in the television show, Jesus has not been in a life-altering accident, but he has intentionally chosen a life-altering experience. By choosing to become the Word made flesh, he has altered his very composition to be Emmanuel, God with us, fully human and fully divine. From the moment that he chose to become both fully human and fully divine, he modeled for us what it looks like to live contrary to one's privilege and position. The radical decision to be like us and to be with us distinguishes him from those in power who are more interested in distancing themselves and being as unlike the masses as possible. In the first chapter of Mark, it is recorded that he hears a voice from heaven saying, "You are my son, the beloved. With you, I am well pleased." Not only does he know who he is, but anyone who heard these words knows who he is. Jesus would be able to answer Dr. Yang's questions easily. He knows who he is and tries to share that with his disciples. He knows what has happened to him. And yes, he is committed to and wants to live this way. It seems that the difficult part of his certainty is getting the disciples to share that certainty about him and about themselves as well. What happens when we choose these questions as we reflect on our own journey? Perhaps we will come away with a better understanding of what is asked and expected of us as modern-day disciples. The first question is deceptively simple. Do you know who you are? Well, of course we know who we are, don't we? We know our names, our birth dates, even if we change the year to something a little more palatable for our egos on occasion. We know how to show up for our jobs and how to function in social settings. The question that looms overhead is, do you know who you are as a follower of Jesus? Do you know that this identity involves being a disruptor? Do you know that this identity means that you are not at liberty to go with the flow, but you are in the company of others who have also identified as such and who were also called to challenge the status quo? Do you know that this identity means rejecting much of what is popular, much of what is lucrative, and much of what appears to meet the standards of success? When we say that we are followers of Jesus the Christ, we also proclaim that we do not subject ourselves to the world's rules of engagement. There are choices that we must make every day, and those choices are the ones that serve as markers of our identity. Do we find ways to feed the hungry? Or do we prefer to secure our own seat at the table? Do we find ourselves walking with the marginalized in our society? Or do we prefer to center ourselves at all costs? Do we, like the disciples, argue about who is the greatest while working to earn our top follower badge? Or do we spend our time speaking words of encouragement to the downtrodden? Since actions speak louder than words, it seems reasonable to suggest that our discipleship is not marked by a badge or a name tag or a lapel pin. Rather, it is marked by our ability to live in ways that closely resemble the life of the one who taught us by example. Jesus never flashed credentials to confirm his identity. He opted to live into his call and his identity through compassion, companionship, and collaboration. What might we do this week that more closely resembles the identity of a follower of the one who came to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives, and a recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor? Now let us consider the second question. Do you know what has happened to you? The behavior of the disciples gives us some perspective. They were called away from their lives and families, and there's no record of how they processed this major life change. Could it be that their failure to understand who Jesus was calling them to be was a trauma response to leaving everything familiar to them? They did not have the option to ease into the life of discipleship. They were all in with a very patient Jesus leading them. So when we read with a bit of compassion, it does not come as a big surprise that they had so much trouble figuring it out. Perhaps for someone who has not had an experience that allows them to trust God, this feels like a setup. How can we agree to follow if we don't have a clear understanding of the terms? How can anyone be expected to engage in this lifestyle when the leader speaks of being handed over to be killed? Indeed, something must have happened to us to allow us to follow this strange teacher. But what? That is the question. Do you know what has happened to you? Do you know what happens to us when we decide to follow this teacher? It is possible that we find ourselves gifted with eyes that can see something more expansive than what is before us. We find ourselves not alone in the work of repairing the world, but in good company as we do our part. It is possible that our eyes are open to new possibilities that were once obscured by the limitations placed on us by the status quo. It is possible that we will no longer see a need for tools of oppression and separation, because this expansive view will show us the benefit of seeing the value of every person, and not just those who look like, live like, vote like, or love like us. And believe me when I say, this may cause onlookers to ask, what has happened to you? We may need to have a more detailed answer than to say, Jesus happened to me. Perhaps we will say that we have seen justice in action and we want to participate. Perhaps we will say that we have seen love in action and we want to participate. Perhaps we will say that we have seen evidence of the beauty of the beloved community and we long to participate actively instead of passively. The answers are as varied as our circumstances, but we are all invited to thoughtfully and prayerfully consider our answer and what it looks like to live into it. The last of Dr. Gang's three questions is, do you want to live this way? In the text, the disciples are arguing about who is the greatest, and Jesus does not address this question as they expect, but he does provide information for them to consider. We don't know whose house they have entered, but there is a child in the house. We don't know whose child suddenly appears and is brought to the center, but Jesus is consistent in his ability to bring those who have been rendered invisible to the center of our field of vision. Jesus takes this child, quite possibly one of the most vulnerable humans in the house, and takes the child into his arms, creating a safe space for the child in this gathering of very important adults. And Jesus tells his followers that whoever wants to be first must be servant of all. Can you imagine the tension that must have built in that room as he uttered those words? Can you imagine? Not how the disciples heard the lesson that was being taught in that moment, but how those who were servants, the unnamed, the invisible, the marginalized, even in the text, must have felt. While the disciples may have thought that they were special because they had been chosen, called, and invited to follow this teacher, he makes it plain that it is not their proximity to him that counts. It is their willingness to be in proximity to others. I'm careful here to avoid the classic designation of the least of these because it still feeds off of our need to be greater than someone else. Jesus says, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." This is what it means to live this way. It is a way of living that makes room for everyone and gives special consideration to those who have been overlooked, oppressed, forgotten, thrown away, or simply ignored. Both Dr. Yang and Jesus remind us that this is completely our choice. Do you want to live this way? Do you want to live a life where we are constantly rearranging notions of who is deserving of our care? Do we want to live our lives knowing that we will be swimming upstream in an effort to welcome those who fit the criteria of one such child? Are we willing to sacrifice our own position and privilege to become servants of all? On the television show, Dr. Yang imagined the possibilities that came with different answers to the questions. We are afforded the same opportunity. God presents us with an opportunity to consider these questions for ourselves and to imagine the possible outcomes. On this day, we sit with our teacher who asks us to do a self-assessment. On this day, we are reminded of the privilege of being God's beloved community, and we are asked to do a brief check-in. Beloved, do you know who you are? Beloved, do you know what has happened to you? Beloved, do you want to live this way? Let us consider what it means and what it costs to say yes. Then, let us live for the chance to reflect, recalibrate, and remember who we are. We say, thanks be to God.
our preacher today was the Reverend Carla Jones Brown. For a free transcript of her sermon, From Childish to Childlike, you can visit us online at dayone.org. Friends, I've got some exciting news to share with you. You know how Day One has been coming to you over the airways for almost 80 years now? Well, we have just teamed up with the folks at the Pitts Theology Library over at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Their stellar archivists and theological librarians have started work on creating an amazing new web presence for Day One, where you'll be able to access thousands of sermons from our archives. It will be like a treasure trove of inspiration. Now, here's the thing. This partnership is fantastic, but it doesn't cover our day-to-day costs of getting these broadcasts out to you every week. We still need your help, just like we always have for almost 80 years now. If you've been blessed in any way by what we do here at Day One, we'd be so grateful if you could support us. You can donate online at dayone.org/donate. Or, if you prefer, you can mail a check to our office in Atlanta, and that address is Day One, 3535 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite 520/714, Atlanta, Georgia, 30326. Regardless of your ability to help financially, you can still support this ministry by telling your friends and family about Day One. And your prayers are always welcome and sincerely appreciated. Whatever you can do, we are just so thankful to have you as part of our Day One family. Thanks for sticking with us, and here's to many more years of sharing God's Word together. Next week on Day One, the Right Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton, senior pastor of the Chautauqua Institution, explores the fine line between judgment and discernment in our faith journey in his sermon entitled, Here Comes the Judge. From left-handed tennis players to ancient biblical conflicts, Bishop Sutton weaves a compelling narrative that will make you reconsider what it truly means to judge not. Don't miss this insightful message. That's next week, right here on Day One. So this sermon is such a gift, Carla, and I just feel like the disciples' misunderstanding and fear is so relatable when we think about our own struggles to understand God's plan in the current world we live in. Mm-hmm. So what's one message you have for those of us feeling disoriented about our call in the world?
Sit and reflect and figure out what about this is making me anxious. What is mine and what is God's? What I find from my own personal reflection, when I am trying to do God's work, that's when I'm most anxious and least effective. When I do my part, which can be as simple as holding the hand of a stranger and praying with them and surprising them with that simple act, do your part. Just do your part and it'll be okay. And it's enough.
I love the set of questions that you quote Dr. Yang asking in the Grey's Anatomy episode. I mean, it's just great. Do you know who you are? Do you know what's happened to you? Do you want to live this way?
Do you know this is going to be a sermon?
Oh. Do you know that whatever comes out of your mouth in response is going to be a sermon? I mean, can you... I'm thinking of one time when I had a concussion. Can you recall moments in your own life when you were clearly confronted by one or more of those questions?
Almost every day that ends in the letter Y, if we're using the English spelling of the word. I feel like an old church lady when I say this. At this particular age, when you're... So for me, in my 50s, let me go ahead and just put that out there. There is so much that has happened and has changed in my life. And if I don't ask myself, do you know who you are if who I am today is the same as who I was on this date a year ago, that's a problem. There's been no growth, right? Do you know what has happened to you? Of course, I complain about it in prayer. I mean, I take it to the Lord in prayer. But what has happened to you, how you perceive what has happened to you, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can also be a good thing. And do you want to live this way is the toughest of them all. Ugh. Do you want to be a person who is known for compassion, which might mean sacrificing some other things, right? Which may mean you're going to have to touch people that other people might not want to touch. And as much as we applauded Mother Teresa for the way that she engaged in the world, we applauded her, but we didn't exactly flock to do what she was doing, right? Yeah. So do you want to live this way? This is what it means. I don't feel called to go to Calcutta. I'm not trying to be Mother Teresa. But what can I do here in my own city, my own town, my own state, and in the U.S. as we move toward the presidential election in a few months? That question, do you know who you are? And are you acting as the person you know yourself to be, or are you acting out of character?
Yeah.
I think, and I'm asking myself, these are not questions to ask your opponents or your perceived opponents. These are questions to ask yourself or to have a trusted friend ask of you to do your own work.
Well, there's another quote that really, so many, that speak to me from your sermon. It's just so rich. Do we want to live a life where we're constantly rearranging notions of who is deserving of our care? Do we want to live our lives knowing that we will be swimming upstream in an effort to welcome those who fit the criteria of one such child? Can we sit with that a little bit more? Can we unpack that more? Because the rearranging notions of who is deserving of our care, wow, we humans are real good at screwing that up.
Mm-hmm. There's the literal thinking of who fits the criteria of one such child. I think, again, as a U.S. citizen who lives in the Northeast, so to speak, when I look at the state of our public education systems and I look at, and I think about the fact that the phrase school to prison pipeline is a real thing. Adults are responsible for that, not the children who are in the schools.
Yep.
School shootings are the things that are moving us to think about gun regulations and laws. That seems backwards to me. So the literal one such child, if one child is hungry, we need to fix that. If one child doesn't have a place to sleep or doesn't have what they need for school, we need to fix that. You know, anyone of my friends who's teaching or who does a school supplies drive, I have a budget line item in our annual household budget. Like, okay, I'm going to give this amount of money because I know that people are going to do these kinds of fundraisers. And that's the smallest thing. Rearranging notions of who is deserving of our care. Can I just, if I just answer that as U.S. healthcare system? And again, I am privileged to be a part of that system, but that system also requires you to have a job to then have benefits. You have to have some kind of income to have good health. That is mind-boggling to me. And again, that's in the hands of adults. And so what does it mean to say that some people should have the best healthcare? How do we put best on healthcare? Is not every person's life worth investing in and keeping people healthy and whatever that looks like? You are right. There's so much to unpack in both of those. But I also, as I think about the church and I think about welcoming those who fit the criteria of one such child, in my lifetime, the conversation of the open communion table has been debated, discussed, et cetera, et cetera. That is interesting to me that we who have studied theology, we who have said yes to a particular call, and now I'm speaking in specific Protestant church terms. So let me say I am not pointing at any other churches that do this. But the notion that we have to think about who can come to God's table is I don't know. That's a thing that makes me wonder. It took us this long to get to this conversation where we can say. So one of my favorite communion songs. The lyrics are, "This is God's table, it's not yours or mine. Come to the table of grace."
Yeah.
Who am I to stand behind that table and to gatekeep and to say, no, you may not have this piece of bread that represents something that's far beyond me.
Yeah, and I feel like that it's pastors like you who've had the gift / burden in their journey of being in two different denominations. Like, I feel like it's those of you who've had to do that work are often, not always, of course, but often the ones in the room who can speak most from the most experience about what it's like to have really different understandings of, of communion. Like you named them, it's the Lord's Supper and it's baptism. Mm-hmm. And it gets us right to what you were talking about with constantly rearranging notions of who deserves to have our care, come to the table, all the things. Well, you know, another set of wisdom that I experience from you is around, you know, balancing the call to serve others with the need to also care for ourselves, particularly in a culture that equates busyness with worth. Carla, what tools or strategies have you found helpful lately in this impossible tension?
So one, again, this, and here's me speaking from a position of privilege, and I'm going to just put that out there at the very beginning. My monthly subscription to the local massage place so that it's automatically withdrawn from my account and I can just make my appointment at any given time. And for those who do not have the means to do that, you can teach someone to massage you properly and appropriately for free or for an exchange of making a grilled cheese sandwich or whatever will delight that individual.
I love that. This is real talk. This is this is care of body and soul.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But I also, and in this particular season, I'm struck by, I have managed to curate wonderful groups of friends who have demonstrated in surprising ways that they care for me deeply. So get friends who pay attention to you and who will not let you just say, "Oh no, I'm fine," who will almost force you to have a good time, who will move in ways that say, "I honor you as an introvert and I'm going to take you to your favorite place." Here we go with the theme, to have grilled cheese sandwich and tomato soup because I know you like that.
Carla, thank you so much for the gift of you, the gift of this sermon, and for being with us today.
Thank you, Katie, for the invitation and for what feels like a big girl play date.
I love it. You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 79 years, proclaiming God's hope for a hurting and divided world. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. Visit us online at dayone.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.